Welcome back everyone to Tarikh Nadab, the podcast where we explore Morocco's millennia-old heritage through sourced stories. I'm your host, Aya, and today we begin something new, let's just say. Something I've been wanting to build for a long time. A new series that opens up the Moroccan political system from the inside out. Now, I'm not here to give you opinions. That's just not my place at all, and it would be a disservice to each and every one of you, and also honestly just criminal, to interrupt your process of intellectualizing Morocco's politics and really building a reasoning of your own around it. I just think I would not forgive myself. So think of this series as a guided reading. You will hear me use that word a lot, logic, because in this country, power doesn't always look like it does in textbooks. It has its own ways of self-expression. And I don't mean this to say it is some mystical rhythm, but the continuity of power in Morocco, which is an extremely rare occurrence in the global stage, it means it is shaped by centuries of geography, crisis, negotiation, survival. My goal is to give you keys of understanding, tools to think from within the country, through its own internal grammar rather than through imported templates. I really wanted to dedicate this series not only to the political junkies out there, but most importantly to anyone who wants to live or to speak about this country with more precision, more respect, and more clarity. Because clarity is power. So here again, welcome. We start off with the monarchy for obvious reasons, being that it is the most central institution there is in Morocco. And also because, oddly, it might be the most misunderstood of all, as too often the conversation about it is either romanticized or dismissed. Time to do better. So let's begin. For those of you that have not gathered yet, I am Moroccan in the best, most incurable way. And over the last 22 years, I spent experiencing, testing, stretching my Moroccanness, I have learned this. The truth about this country that I am so beyond words proud to call home is never where you expect it to be. And while that raises serious problems of predictability, it also means that in order to grasp it, one must experience it. It hides in plain sight, and yet we miss it. In the gaps, in what goes without saying, and closely dealing with the unspoken as much as it is convenient when you live inside the borders, can prove itself to be quite challenging once you step out of home. The Moroccan monarchy is one of those things that tend to go without much explanation at all. And as a Moroccan international that has lived outside Morocco for years now, I have heard all kinds of things and all kinds of takes about it. In my experience when I was a teenager and didn't have the tools yet or the need to dig deep into how Moroccan politics actually were, most of what I absorbed, and it didn't come down to much, came through fragments, crumbles of information that I got from the heated sometimes discussions between mom and her sisters, dad and his brothers over tea. And just like in any other place around the world, if you grow up in Morocco, that often feels like it's enough. The texture of Moroccan politics filters through your life quite naturally, but the gaps don't really get exposed until you leave. The trouble begins when you meet the other with a big O, especially that specific other who lives so close to home, apparently literally on the other side of the Mediterranean, yet so far away somehow in Europe. Because there is a habit, a persistent one, of explaining your world, your reality, with frameworks which were never ever built to understand it. Morocco's political reality gets described using borrowed terms and templates that are familiar to European history. It obscures more than it reveals. And so you'll watch silently at first as they mistake what is functional for what is broken. If I had a dollar each time I got told that Morocco is stuck in some outdated power structure, or that the monarchy is nothing but a crown resting on the shoulders of a dead idea, I ain't gonna lie, I would not be sitting here recording this episode. I would be off on a sailboat. I would have bought from that money somewhere in the Mediterranean, living it up with no intention of ever making it back to civilization ever again. That's how rich I would be. In France especially, somehow you get this idea that in order to walk toward the future, you must first unseat the past. And maybe in many places around the world, that has proven to be true. But Morocco isn't like many places. Our monarchy isn't some sort of unhealthy weight we carry from the past that we drag behind us. That is never how I have seen it. Growing up, as most Moroccan kids do, you do sort of feel its presence in the atmosphere. The monarchy was there, in the background, like a constant, intangible, close enough to be almost part of the air itself, but also distant enough to feel untouchable in the most gracious way. For those of you that are just being introduced to Moroccan politics with this episode, hi, glad you're here. The monarchy in Morocco is the engine room, the powerhouse. It drafts and it sets the directions of the Moroccan state. It contains its oh-so-natural contradictions, and perhaps most importantly, it absorbs its risks. It has been one of Morocco's few constants over the centuries. The Sultanate was the earliest form of the monarchy, so to speak, its ancestor, both in structure and in spirit. Dynasties have risen and they have fallen, subtly or slowly depending on the era, but the monarchy has endured by maneuvering through the rupture rather than by holding rigidly to its old ways. From a historical standpoint, I like to think of it as a tree that has been around for centuries and that has seen it all. Probably an organ tree, carved by centuries of pressure. Deeply rooted, inevitably scarred, central, and still throwing new shade on its surroundings. In this episode, we'll examine the internal architecture of this institution, its structure, the logic beneath its political gestures, the way the throne interacts with law, with faith, and identity. Now, I'm not gonna sit here and pretend it is simple. It just isn't. Morocco is a country that is full of tensions. And on top of it all, to understand the Moroccan monarchy, you need to begin where the frameworks end. The Moroccan monarchy does not function as a European constitutional monarchy, nor does it resemble the autocratic dynasties of the Middle East. Structurally, it is something entirely different. And to describe it, we must begin with its architecture, then its legal and constitutional grounding, then its informal mechanisms, and finally, the way it has adapted throughout the years. The root of the Moroccan monarchy is its Sharifian legitimacy. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with Sharifianism, what it means is the currently ruling Alawi dynasty claims direct descendants from the Prophet, peace be upon him, and has done so for four entire centuries. It is worth mentioning at this stage that the Alawi clan has been the executive face of power in Morocco since the mid-17th century, with its first official sultan being Moulay Rachid. The Sharifian legitimacy of the Moroccan monarchy isn't symbolic, as you'll read here and there in some magazines. For Muslims, it is a source of baraka, a religious charisma, so to speak, that binds the throne to the Islamic foundations of the Moroccan state, whose population is largely Muslim. It is a thread that predates colonialism, republicanism, and the modern notions of the nation-state, and it has historically been absolutely instrumental in securing the allegiance of tribes, as well as the loyalty of religious orders over the centuries and later political elites. In Article 41 of the Moroccan Constitution, the king is defined not just as the head of state, but as Emir Mu'minin, the commander of the faithful. This particular title is grounded in centuries-old Islamic jurisprudence and gives him a specific role to protect the faith of believers, to lead the Islamic way, to make sure the population stays united in their religion. All in all, to act as the highest religious authority. It gives the king sole jurisdiction over religious interpretation. What that translates to is the king is allowed to oversee mosques, the process of issuing a fatwa, religious education, and the appointment of the ulama. Most importantly, he is the one responsible for leading reform of Islamic discourse in Morocco. The monarchy has full control over the religious sphere, as the king also oversees this domain through institutions like the Ministry of Islamic Affairs and the High Council of Ulama, which he personally leads. All of these bodies shape the religious messages that are delivered and taught in schools through religious programs. It is a central centralized approach, much like that of Republican states for matters like education. A vertical dynamic. Historically, that is how the monarchy has maintained religious stability in a country where different Islamic traditions have existed for centuries. By guiding the national religious narrative, the monarchy also works to prevent the spread of extremist ideas. Now, let's talk a little bit about a concept which I have mentioned time and time again in my long and short formats from a historical standpoint, the concept of the mkhzen. As of present, the term mkhzen kind of has a negative connotation to it. In Morocco, it is commonly used to designate the administration. That can be pretty exhausting to deal with for Moroccans, but let's go back to its original meaning. The mkhzen, which sustains the monarchy and has been for centuries, is a pre-modern but still highly functional network of power. It includes the royal palace, the Ministry of Interior, security services, regional governors, traditional leaders, and a defined set of loyal elites, people with close ties to the royal family. Though this notion is quite old, I must say, do not be mistaken. The mkhzen, the central government, if we were to translate it, is not some sort of shadow government. Think of it as an enduring state structure that mediates between formal institutions and the people, sometimes efficiently and sometimes very clumsily. It manages local governance, crisis, intelligence, the interests of the state, often much beyond what is visible in the constitution and other legal texts. It is the exercise of power in its realest, rawest form. As of today, the constitution that is in effect is its 2011 version. It defines Morocco as a constitutional monarchy with a separation of powers, human rights protection, and elected institutions. However, it also maintains the king as the supreme arbiter. He presides over the Council of Ministers. He appoints key officials. He oversees religious matters, like we talked about earlier, as well as foreign policy and defense. Constitutionally, the king is above party politics. He governs by dahir. A dahir is kind of like a royal decree, if you will. And he often does so without the oversight of anyone, which means he rules independently. Most of the time, though, he is advised by the royal cabinet, a very tight-knit group of counselors and experts. This setup has been the common practice for Moroccan rulers over the centuries, even when Morocco was still a sultanate. The constitution is designed to allow flexibility, a flexibility that is bounded by the king's will. The text itself enables him to intervene directly and to reform it when he deems necessary. In Morocco, when we say government, you absolutely need to follow it with royal supervision. Morocco has what is called a bicameral parliament, which means a parliament with two chambers. It also has a head of government and a judicial system. All these institutions have real responsibilities to each their own, and the king also plays a central role in that system. He can name or remove ministers, he can dissolve the parliament if he wishes, and the constitution also enables him to step in on major decisions if he deems his intervention necessary. Alongside the elected government, powerful bodies like the Ministry of Interior and the Royal Cabinet tend to carry more weight than other regular ministries, so to speak. These institutions work closely with the king and effectively shape public policies. Take, for instance, security or regional affairs. Those are typically their era of specialty. In the end, while Morocco does hold elections and has formal democratic structures, the elected government naturally operates with parameters set by the royal palace. Now, when it comes to Morocco's judicial system, the constitution promises an independent one. In practice, the king chairs the Supreme Council of the Judiciary and chooses the most important judges. Since the 2011 constitutional reforms, there's been real progress in how the justice system works. Still, the courts often follow the logic of the mkhzen, especially when a case touches on sensitive issues like religion or Morocco's territorial integrity, like the Moroccan Sahara, for example. These issues are handled with extra care and close oversight. The king has a vision for Morocco's future, and he breathes that vision into strategic reforms. And the main word to remember here is calculated modernization. Most of Morocco's biggest reforms have come from the king's initiative. We can mention the family code or even the 2011 constitution, as well as the transitional justice process that is led by the Equity and Reconciliation Commission. These changes often come as a response to real social demands, which goes to show how sensitive King Mohammed VII's Lansro tries to be to them. The monarchy watches and it listens. Reforms are carefully shaped, timed, and carried out under close royal supervision, and that is precisely why these changes are not seen as a challenge to the system. They are a way for the monarchy to adapt itself and to embrace change within the Moroccan body, to evolve with it at its own pace. Now let's talk a bit about crisis management. In times of crisis, whether it's a terrorist attack like in Gaza in May 2003, or a pandemic like COVID-19, or a natural disaster like the earthquakes in Marrakech last year, or even through political unrest of any kind, the monarchy fully steps into the spotlight. He delivers speeches on national television, he launches major initiatives to tackle the crisis at hand, and he may visit areas that are directly affected by the situation. This is a visible show of leadership, that of a head of state who's trying to reassure the public that the state is stable and in control, while also reminding political actors where real authority continues to lie. The monarchy is also an active economic actor in Morocco. It is present in banking, energy, telecommunication, and real estate through the royal holding, Al-Medda, formerly known as the SNI. It has stakes in all those key sectors. At the same time, royal initiatives such as the National Initiative for Human Development, the INDH, and the Mohammed VI Foundation led very ambitious development programs. These programs aimed to reduce inequality and to improve the living conditions of Moroccans across the territory. So the palace kind of has a double economic role. One, it acts as a major investor in Morocco's future, and two, it sometimes steps up as a social actor. What you essentially end up with is a model where the state and the monarchy both work in tandem, combining stability with long-term planning in a way very few institutions could replicate. The monarchy acts as a national glue, a vector of territorial unity. Morocco is trying to achieve unity through diversity. Diversity of language, of region. From the Moroccan Sahara to the Reef region, all the way up north, the monarchy remains the only institution with true symbolic presence across the entire country. It serves as a bridge between Morocco's many layers. Contrary to what it might have done in the past, today, the monarchy isn't erasing difference. It is absorbing it and reconciling all the different parts that makes Morocco. In Emezir villages and among tribes in the Sahara, loyalty to the king runs much deeper than ties to state institutions, which those are often very foreign to the common Moroccan citizen, I must say. There's a personal bond between the people and the monarchy, which we'll need to study in a separate episode because it is rooted in historical reasons. And that has given the monarchy a unique ability to hold together a society that is shaped by many types of existences. Now let's talk a little bit about the monarchy and foreign policy, as it is directly led by the king in Morocco. He is the one who signs all the international agreements himself. He also oversees major partnerships, the most critical ones, and he serves as Morocco's main diplomatic voice and face abroad. His religious status, as we talked about earlier, also gives him a special influence around the world, especially in places like West Africa, where spiritual ties in general matter a lot. Through his own personal diplomacy, independent from that of the ministers and Moroccan diplomats, whether that is in Rabat, in Europe, in Asia, or in African capitals, the king has been the biggest player in shaping Morocco's image as a stable, modern Islamic country with both integrity and adaptability. The monarchy is a meta bridge, so to speak, between Africa, Europe, the Americas, Asia, and the Arab world, putting its most sacred national causes like Morocco's sovereignty over the Sahara as red lines. The king and his team of diplomats have invested heavily whether that is politically, diplomatically, militarily, in securing international support for Morocco's legitimate territorial reclaiming of the Sahara. Any questioning of our sovereignty on the Moroccan Sahara has been a diplomatic deal breaker. In terms of cultural policy, the monarchy also plays a central part. The king actively supports cultural festivals and heritage restoration projects like the official recognition of the Amazigh language, reviving Andalusian music, which is an integral part of Morocco's cultural heritage, promoting our Jewish heritage. All those things have been the product of collective effort, of course, and have been goals that were achieved through decentralized force, but they were all part of the king's desire to make the celebration of Moroccan multiculturalism the core of a state-led deliberate strategy. The monarchy in Morocco is notably involved in the civil society. Of course, NGOs and local associations are active, and generally they're free to operate. But it has happened in the past that when a campaign begins to gain momentum, it ends up connecting with a royal foundation of some kind, as there are many, like the Lella Selma Foundation for Cancer. If an action gets enough clout or targets a main issue that is important for the state, it will get some sort of or some form of backing from the king or any other member of his family. That kind of support can take a small local project and turn it into something of national scale. So in Morocco, you'll often find a mix of grassroots effort and royal endorsement. That's just how the system works sometimes. It keeps things flexible. It allows change to happen, but always within a framework that the monarchy helps shape. And on that note, let's just put pause on this new stream of information you now have to digest. We've gone over the Moroccan monarchy as it functions, a religious authority, a constitutional actor, and an institution of historical depth. I couldn't cover everything, but I tried to give a solid sense of how the system works in practice and on paper. And if you're still with me, then you've understood already that Moroccan politics do not fit the usual boxes. What does that even mean? I couldn't tell you. And that is exactly why all we just did matters. Because once we stop expecting Moroccan politics to behave like a copy of something else, then only can we start learning from it on its own terms, respectfully, rigorously, but always critically. Some parts deserve more time and more space, and we will come back to them over the coming episodes, where we'll move the needle through the different organs of Moroccan power. The executive, the parliament, the judiciary, the mkhzen, the central government, the region governments, political parties, how the system bends or holds under pressure, and so much more. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Make sure you hit me up on Instagram, handle Aya Shukri, very easy. And in the meantime, just keep digging.